Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hello, you're listening to On Israel in Al Monitor. I am Ben Kaspit from Tel Aviv. The crisis that broke out in relations between Moscow and Jerusalem in recent weeks seems to be easing. An Israeli legal team is now in Russia to deal with the ostensible cause of the crisis, Russia's plans to shut down the operations of the Jewish agency that facilitates immigration to Israel. However, this saga is far from over. Putin has yet to speak out on the matter, and as everyone knows, he always has the final say. Vladimir Putin has always been considered a great friend of Israel and a true lover of Jews wherever they are, although the Russians and before them the Soviet Union were always the main strategic supporter of Israel's enemies, whether Arab countries for decades and Iran these days. That's one of the reasons for Israel's decision to adopt a kind of clumsy neutrality when the crisis between Russia and Ukraine broke out, and why it was reluctant to line up with the Western democratic camp when the horrific images emerged from Russia's invasion of Ukraine. But in recent months, with a considerable delay, Israel has joined the United States, Western Europe, and the rest of the enlightened world. Is the order to close the Jewish agency a kind of a reprisal by Putin for this shift in Israeli policy? Will the crisis also lead to friction and perhaps even a confrontation between the Israeli and Russian air forces in the skies over Russia? Our guest today will try to answer these questions. Arkady Milman is the head of the Russia program at the Institute for National Security Studies, INSS. He was Israel's ambassador to Moscow and to Azerbaijan. He'll be here right after a short break.
If you are listening to this podcast, you obviously care about the Middle East, and if you do, you should probably be reading Al Monitor. Al Monitor is a global newsroom headquartered in Washington, D.C., with a network of over 160 contributors around the world. Al Monitor offers first-class reporting and analysis from a range of perspectives and an approach that represents the highest journalistic standards, as well as an award-winning commitment to press freedom and independence. If you haven't done so already, visit us at almonitor.com, check out our articles, and sign up for our free newsletters. There's a lot to choose from, including The Week in Review, an essay that offers unusual insights and forecasts into the region based upon Al Monitor's outstanding reporting. And if you haven't done so, please subscribe to our Al Monitor podcast on your favorite podcast platform, On Israel with Ben Kaspit and On the Middle East with me, Andrew Parasoliti.
Now I am happy to say hello to Arkady Milman, who is the head of the Russia program at the Institute for National Security Studies in Israel, the INSS. Hi, Arkady. How are you doing? And thank you for joining us here in On Israel in Al Monitor.
Thank you.
Okay, let's start with the current crisis in Israel-Russia relations around the activities of the Jewish agency in Russia. Is this a technical bureaucratic clash, or is it something deeper to do with Russia's dissatisfaction with Israel's transition from relative objectivity to support for Ukraine and the West with regard to Russia's invasion?
The crisis is definitely not technical bureaucratic, but it is also not directly connected to the change of the Israeli position on the war issue. First of all, because there was no significant change in the Israeli position. Israel hasn't started to supply weapons to Ukraine. The loan that Ukraine requested, 500 million, hasn't been approved, etc. There are more examples. Secondly, the war was only a catalyst to a long-time process of worsening of Russia's relations with the West. And Israel, as a part of the West in Russian eyes, couldn't avoid it. I would say that the crisis around Sokhnut that we see today is mostly the result of internal processes in Russia. For the last decade, the atmosphere there became more and more hostile towards foreigners, including towards locals who receive financial support from outside Russia. If we add to the formula rising levels of anti-Semitism and the war in Ukraine as a strong catalyst of the hostility towards the West, this is the result that we see today.
So you say actually it's a lot deeper than what you see with the agency or the war. It's an historical maybe a crisis or process. So I want to ask you about the Jewish agency's problems with the Russian government. They began a few years ago and have intensified steadily, long before the current crisis. Are the Russians simply trying to take advantage of an existing but small bushfire to turn it into the threat of a forest wildfire? Or actually what you said is this is a process, and the Sokhnut issue is an opportunity for the Russians to go ahead with the crisis.
Ben, look, actually this is one of the favorite Russian tactics, to create a small fire and then, when the time is convenient, to make a full-fledged crisis out of it. We see it in the internal politics, when minor criminal cases are being started against oppositionists. And then, sometimes years after, people get arrested and go to jail. The last case is the case of Leonid Gozmazn with Israeli citizenship. We also see it in the Russian foreign policy, for example. Russia occupied Donetsk and Luhansk provinces of Ukraine in 2014. And in 2022, claimed there was a genocide of Russian-speaking populations there and used it as one of the pretexts to invade Ukraine. Coming back to the Sokhnut, in my opinion, yes, of course, Russia can use the same tactics here, but at the moment, and I underscore at the moment, I have to say that I don't see the desire on the Russian side to create a full-scale conflict with Israel. On the contrary, it seems like the tensions is calming down now. But remember, the potential of escalation is still there.
So let's talk about the Jews in Russia. There are over 150,000 Jews living in Russia. To what extent is the agency's activity there still vital to Israeli interests in terms of aliyah, immigration, relations with Russian Jews, and so on? There are those who believe that the agency has long been an unnecessary organization, the Sokhnut. One of them, by the way, is Yasha Kedmi, who has served as a liaison between Russia and Israel for decades and was instrumental in the mass immigration of Jews from Russia in the 1990s. What do you think?
First of all, 150,000 Jews, I think that we don't know exactly the number. Maybe it's more. And there is also the category that we have the people that they have the right to make aliyah to Israel, but they are not a Jewish population. And I think the numbers are higher that you mentioned. Sokhnut has been doing a very important job in Russia for the last 30 years. It's a fact. And it's important for Israel, and it's important for the local Jewish communities. And it's not only about aliyah, it's also about the connection with Israel, the Jewish identity, Jewish history, tradition, culture, language, Hebrew, and much more. If Sokhnut eventually closes, it will be very difficult to find a replacement to it. Now, you mentioned Yasha Kedmi. In this regard, I want to say something. This person constantly, in these days, in these months, participates in one of the most infamous propagandistic TV shows of Kremlin, side by side with another Jewish person, Vladimir Solovyov, who is now under Western sanctions of EU and the United States. So in this context, I suggest to be very cautious and rely on his words.
So actually you said it's too early to say that the Sochnut has fulfilled its historic title or job or mission. So let's talk about someone you know very well. I'm talking about President Vladimir Putin. Many claim that he was a special warm place for the Jewish people. You were the one who brought him as president of Russia on a historic visit to Israel in 2006. What can you tell us about his attitude towards the Jews and Israel, the many interests that he is dealing with, etc.?
The picture is not one-dimensional. It's very difficult to explain in a few sentences Putin's feelings about Jews and Israel. And you're right. On one hand, during the years of his power, the Jewish community life had flourished, without doubt, any doubt. And so had the relations between Russia and Israel. He's the only Russian leader who visited Israel twice. I correct you, the first visit, historical visit, was in 2005, and the second was in 2012.
Okay.
On the other hand, vis-a-vis Jewish community, Putin created a very complicated structure of organizations that were favored by him and those that were not. Also, vis-a-vis Israel, not everything was smooth. For example, Russia sold the advanced weapons to Syria and Iran in spite of Israeli protests. Also, people in the close circle to Putin, they are both Jews and anti-Semites. His favorite teacher, for example, who taught him German at school, was Jewish. And when she moved to Israel, he ordered to buy her an apartment in Tel Aviv. It's a very nice act from his side. Some of Jewish oligarchs are his cronies and are under sanctions now. And we have to remember it. But the others were persecuted by him. My personal opinion is that he is not an anti-Semite and not anti-Israel. And as a proof, we see that the relations between Israel and Russia were better than Russian relations with some other Western countries. But, and here's the but, we should understand that the situation changed dramatically after Russian invasion to Ukraine. And Putin's breaking off of the relations with the West will inevitably influence the relations between Israel and Russia. In Putin's eyes, we have to remember this, the United States and the NATO are his biggest enemies. And for Israel, the US is the closest and the most important strategic ally. And we can't ignore this factor.
So we have to be cautious here as well. If there is indeed a significant and deep crisis in Israel-Russia relations, could it spill over from the political diplomatic to the military sphere, and especially to the freedom of action that Israel's Air Force enjoys in the skies over Syria, which are controlled by Russians' radar systems?
First of all, I have to say that the real crisis is not here yet. And I very much hope it won't come. Regarding Syria, we should remember that in giving Israel freedom of action there, Russia is not doing us any favors. It's her strategic interest too, that Iran doesn't develop strong military presence there in Syria. And Putin is happy that Israel is doing the job for him. And still there's, of course, a lot of sensitivity around the Russian military presence in Syria, and in the overall balance of the relations, it's one of the main factors that Israel should consider.
Can you explain to us Putin's participation in what is being called in the West the Evil Summit in Tehran, together with President Raisi and Turkish President Erdogan? Should Israel feel threatened by such an event, or is Putin trying to create alternative moves and markets for himself after being cast as a pariah by the West?
Okay, I will explain. For Putin, this visit was an opportunity to demonstrate these three countries' partnership against the West, to show to the world and to his domestic audience that Russia is not isolated and that there is international willingness to accept a multipolar world order that is not led by the United States alone. Military cooperation with Iran is another interest of Putin, and we know this, that it was discussed during the meetings. Moreover, during the visit, the draft agreement on strategic cooperation was exchanged. And this draft includes a section on military technical cooperation. This agreement is designed to replace the previous agreement between the two states that expired in 2020. Until the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Russia limited its military cooperation with Iran for fear of Western response. But this constraint no longer exists, and Russia might offer Iran advanced military technologies that until now were beyond its reach. There were also reports that Russia is interested to buy from Iran hundreds of UAVs for use in Ukraine. It's unbelievable. There is a question and also a doubt if Iran has the capacity to produce high numbers of UAVs in a short time. In the Syrian context, there was a joint Iranian-Russian interest to prevent Turkey from launching a new operation in northern Syria. It seems that they haven't succeeded in that. We also know that Tehran officials raised the subject of Israeli attacks in Syria in the conversation with Putin. But eventually, this issue was not included in the final summary of the summit. An agreement between Russia and Iranian oil companies was signed, according to which Russian company Gazprom, a well-known company, will invest $40 billion in the Iranian oil and gas industry. The experts have doubts that the Russian side will have such money to invest, especially with the war in the background. Having said all that, it's important to emphasize that the summit in Tehran reflected only partial conflicts of interests for the three countries, alongside, I will say, continued disagreements, opposing interests, and mutual suspicions.
Very interesting. And by the way, it's really unbelievable that the Russians, the superpower, are trying to buy armed UAVs from Tehran. By the way, according to foreign media, Israel just destroyed a few months ago a huge hangar with hundreds of such drones in Tehran. I hope the President Putin is not angry with us because of this. But let's try to get into Putin's head. You are one of the Israelis who knows him best, as best as possible. Do you think he regrets the adventure of the invasion of Ukraine? If you could take him back 7 months ago, would he still do it? Is there a chance that at some point he will try to reach a reasonable agreement, declare victory, and return to Moscow? Or is this war with us to stay?
It's a difficult question.
Yes.
I can't say that I know Putin better than any other Israeli, but really I had quite a few hours with him, and so I will try. Putin had several goals that he wanted to reach in the war in Ukraine. To change, first of all, to change the regime in Kyiv for a puppet government that he will be able to run. Second, to prevent NATO from expanding east of Ukraine. Third, not to let Ukraine to become a member of European Union. And there are other goals in this war. Objectively looking, he failed in all that. What he succeeded to do, in my opinion, in the moment, it's to occupy territories in eastern and southern parts of Ukraine and to create a corridor between Donbas, its eastern part of Ukraine, to the Crimea Peninsula that he occupied in 2014. But in my opinion, this achievement is temporary. And why? Because the Ukrainian army is receiving massive weapon supplies from the US and some European countries, and the Ukrainian army is preparing a counterattack. Today, Ukrainians are feeling that if the Western support continues, and it continues, they can win, at least partly. So I don't see a possibility to impose on them an agreement that defines the status quo as it is today. So my estimation would be that the war will continue, at least till the end of the year, if not longer. Regarding your question, if Putin regrets that he started the war, I would support that he does not. First of all, I'm not sure if he receives correct and full information about what happens there, the amount of losses, etc. Secondly, it's not in his psychology to regret. He is deeply convinced that he is right and the war was justified and necessary for the Russian national interests.
History showed us many nations or armies that invaded Russia and regretted it. We can talk about Napoleon and about the Germans, but not vice versa. And maybe this is the first time it can happen, although I think you are right. I don't know anything about the Russian type of thinking, but it is not in the Russian psychology or culture to regret such a move. And finally, another tough question: if the situation continues to deteriorate, do you think that Putin would resort to the limited use of unconventional weapons, something like tactical nuclear weapons or in isolated areas or chemical weapons, if the worst happens?
I would be happy to give a negative answer to this question. But I remember, as in February, when the question, will Putin invade Ukraine, was asked, most experts were convinced that he would not. So unfortunately, when we deal with a totalitarian leader whose rationale is not always clear to us, we can't rule out any possibility. Of course, there are some experts that they think that there's a 5-stage activation of nuclear weapon in Russia. So there is the opinion also that the military person that is responsible for this 5-stage activation will not do it. But really, in this situation with this totalitarian leader, we really can't rule out any possibility. But I'm also quite sure that if the West sends Putin a clear and confident message that any nuclear strike will be retaliated with a nuclear strike on Russia, it will be a serious deterrent for him.
It's very interesting, very worrying, but a fascinating talk. I want to thank you, Arkady Milman, for joining us here today in Al Monitor. Thank you very much for this question, for this conversation. We will be right back after this short break. Thank you, Arkady. Toda rabah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm Andrew Parasoliti, president of the award-winning media news site Al Monitor, where we cover the Middle East with some of the best reporters and columnists anywhere. And I'm excited to announce our new podcast, On the Middle East, where each week I will interview newsmakers from the U.S. and the region about the latest news and trends with additional commentary from our on-the-ground correspondents. Those of you who follow the region know that what happens in the Middle East doesn't stay in the Middle East. And to cite another great movie line, every time the U.S. tries to get out, the region pulls us back. Your time is valuable, so let me promise you this. You will learn something and you will never be bored, because each week we'll be talking with and listening to those leaders who are making the news and shaping the trends in this critical and fascinating region. So please subscribe to On the Middle East with me, Andrew Parasoliti.
Thank you for staying with us. The big question about who is the real Vladimir Putin, a Jew lover and an Israel supporter or vice versa, could not be answered in this interesting conversation with Ambassador Arkady Milman. The situation is a little more complicated, and as he said, the Russian president is not a one-dimension person. There are many sides. Of course, Jewish life in these times flourished in the what was the Soviet Union and now is Russia. On the other hand, it created a very complicated structure. Many Jewish oligarchs or just Jews are under boycott or had to flee Russia. On one hand, his favorite teacher from childhood was Jewish, and he bought her an apartment when she immigrated, made an aliyah to Israel. And on the other hand, he just came back from the evil summit in Tehran, etc., etc. So Putin is everything. Only Putin will decide if in the next months or years he will be pro-Israel or against it. An interesting analysis by Ambassador Milman was that Vladimir Putin is not anti-Semite, of course, and also not such a Jew lover, but the situation changed dramatically in recent weeks or months after the invasion of Russia to the Ukraine, when he found NATO and the United States as his worst enemies on the other side, and Israel now is aligning with them. This can be dangerous, and Putin can find himself, or we can find him, on the wrong side of the equation. When we spoke about the crisis around the Jewish agency's action in Russia, Ambassador Milman said the crisis is not technical or bureaucratic, but it's not necessarily connected to the Jewish agency, but maybe, as we said, to the Israeli stand right now in the Ukraine. But the ambassador said that he does not recognize a significant change in the Israeli stand in Ukraine, although Naftali Bennett is not there anymore and Yair Lapid is leaning more to the West, but there is not such a difference between them. What Milman said is that the crisis is maybe a result of a long internal process in Russia that took it far from the West, from democracy, many things that happened in a period of 1, 2, or 4 years and brought us to the place where we are now. And maybe it's an example to a Russian expertise, like Ambassador Milman described us, to lit a small fire. He called it one of the favorite Russian tactics, to create a small crisis and then use it when you like to use it and make it bigger. You can make a big drama out of it in order to get the results you want. One of the key points was, I think, in the end of the conversation, when I asked him if the situation will go on deteriorating from the Russian point of view, can Putin consider or even try or act or use an unconventional weapon, like chemical weapon or maybe a nuclear, tactical nuclear weapon? And Ambassador Milman, that knows Putin and served in Moscow, said that he would be very happy to give us negative answer, but he cannot do it because he said, when we asked all the analysts in February, back in the beginning of this year, if he's going to invade, if Putin will really invade the Ukraine in the end, most of them answered no. So why answer no now when the invasion is a failure and the situation of the Russian army is not getting better? And he said it can be solved or it can be blocked only by a very clear demonstration of will by the West that will say that any nuclear attack by Russia on the Ukraine will be retaliated immediately with a similar attack on Russia. This can be the cure or can solve these possibilities, horrific possibilities of deterioration in Europe. We'll meet here next week in the same place on Israel in Al Monitor. I hope you enjoyed it or find it interesting. I am Ben Kaspit from Tel Aviv. Take care and bye-bye.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.